Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Hi there, friends. Hey, this might be a bit weird or even a bit random, as my son Louis would say, but a lot of people have asked me lately how Emily and I got together to make Australian True Crime. Well, the story is that I was doing my other podcast, The Nitty Gritty Committee, which is just interviews with people I find interesting, really. And I've popped the link in the show notes here in case you want to go and have a go of it, because there's lots of different kinds of conversations over there. And I know a lot of people are taking breaks, so maybe you're desperate. Honestly, maybe you want to go over there and have a go. Anyway, there's some people over there that you might have heard of, like philosopher Alain de Botton. I mean, that's just fun to say, Alain de Botton. There's David Williams from Little Britain. Kyle Sanderlands, who I promise I'm going to make you like. I know you don't believe that, but it's true. There's Danica Weeks, whose husband Paul was on MH370. And you'll never forget what she says about that, about her life since then. It's incredible. War correspondent Michael Ware. He was the first person to alert the world to the organization we now know as ISIS. He might be crazy. It's really hard to say. John Ramsey, father of JonBenet Ramsey, talked to me about the documentary that purported to prove that his son was her killer. That was quite a chat. Anyway, so I was doing that podcast, right? And one day I was looking around for interesting people to interview, and I stumbled upon a book that I really enjoyed, because I've always loved true crime, of course. I was always reading true crime. And I found this book called Suburban Nightmares, about crimes around Melbourne, where I was living. So I thought I'd see if the author would be interested in coming in and podcasting with me. Her name was Emily Webb. She was interested. She did come in, and I enjoyed our hour so much that by the end of it, I said, would you ever want to do a true crime podcast with me? That was September 2016. We launched Australian True Crime in November 2016, and we've been at it ever since. We've hit 10 million downloads, probably. It's hard for us to know because we didn't know how to count our downloads for the first 8 months. But as I'm recording this now, we know we've got 9.8 million for sure. So we've probably hit 10 million. Anyway, here's the bit that's possibly random. While we are on our Christmas break, I wondered if you would want to hear that original interview. I should let you know, though, that our second tier patrons are enjoying a very revealing, exclusive, brand new interview with Ron Iddles about the Lawyer X scandal that's rocking the Victorian police force this week. It turns out that there are lots of big personalities and old scores to be settled in that one. Let's just say that there'll be some people we know and love who are absolutely living for this. Yes, you'll know what I mean when you hear that. Anyway, if you want to get into that and you're not a patron yet, you can just go to patreon.com/austtruecrimepod, AUST, True Crime Pod. And for $5 a month, it's like the cost of a coffee. I should say it's $5 American. It's an American website. So that's honestly two coffees, Australian coffees a month. And you get this episode and other free stuff. It's totally worth it. Shout yourself. It's Christmas. Okay. And you'll get that episode. And next week, you'll get a free episode with Vaughn. Remember Vaughn, the Pentridge guard? And we've already recorded it, and it's 110% Vaughn, let me tell you. He's out of control. He's off the leash. Anyway, sit tight. This is just Merry Christmas. This is Emily and I on our nervous first date back in 2016. Oh, and by the way, Emily wants me to tell you that her books are being re-released. She's working on them. She's updating them. So there, of course, there are updates to these stories. There's new information, new stuff. So these books will be out again with new info. Now, nervous, first date, go. I don't know about you, but I love true crime. I love it, and I'm ready to admit it right now to you and to everybody, even though I always feel a bit guilty about it. I think, oh God, am I being ghoulish, reveling in other people's terrible tragedies and dramas? But I don't know if I am. I just love it. God help me. I've read all the books and I've found a new true crime writer, and she is here in Australia. Her name's Emily Webb. She's a bigger fanatic than me. She spends her spare time trawling through old newspapers in the library. I mean, this chick loves it really hard. She has three books that you can get. There's Murder in Suburbia, Nightmare in Suburbia, and Angels of Death. I've read them. They are brilliant. She is a real talent. Her books are fantastic. You must get them. But before you run out and do that, please enjoy this conversation between me and crime writer Emily Webb. I'm Michelle Laurie, and this is the Nitty Gritty Committee, stories about the guts and the glory of life. And this week I'm joined by somebody who is an expert at the guts and the glory of other people's lives. She's a true crime writer, Emily Webb. Hey, Em.
Thanks, Michelle.
Can I call you Em?
Yeah, sure. Everyone calls me Em.
Great. I feel like we're friends because I've been just buried in your book every night and every moment I can get on my Kindle while my kids are watching something else behind me. I'm buried in true crime.
I'm so glad that you're reading it.
I love it. So I am reading Murder in Suburbia, right? That's the first one?
Yeah, that's the first one.
And the new book is Suburban Nightmare.
Yes, it's there's a theme going with those.
There is. Why do we love true crime, do you think?
I think it's the intrigue about stuff that could happen, and often we have a connection with the places. So for me,
yes.
I'm always, the reason I picked suburban settings is, you know, you're like, that could be me, that could be my life. I know that place. I know many of the settings where these murders have happened that I've written about, and it just... the juxtaposition of the brutality of what happens and the, like, brick veneer house, it just freaks me out.
Yeah, because when we look at American true crime, it feels like a show business to me. You know, I can't really see the Avery family as... I can't relate to them. I can't relate to their community, you know, or the people in Serial, for example. And then I pick up your books and it is very, very relatable. I can see the brick veneer. I can smell what they're having for dinner. I can understand their lives. And then you think to yourself, how could this happen? How do these crimes happen?
That's it. And especially when I'm particularly intrigued by cold cases, and ones from the, I guess I was born in the, like, late 70s, I'm a Gen X, and I'm pretty intrigued by ones that happened in the 1980s and 90s, ones that really I can remember from when I was a kid and a teenager.
Because they're the ones that give you nightmares,
yeah,
aren't they?
And
they're the ones that inform your brain.
That's it, and you remember the front page of the,
yes,
like, the newspapers and the photos. And
they're the ones your parents point out to you and say, see, this is what happens when you go out at nighttime, or you sneak out, or you whatever, accept rides from strangers, or whatever your parents take out of it to try and... because they're so frightened when they see these stories, yeah, and look at you, their child.
Yeah, and it does. I'm a mum, and I can get a bit. You can get a bit bogged down with reading about true crime, and reading court documents in particular is quite distressing after a while, because it just the depravity of some crimes is just so full on, and you just can't believe people do it. And that's what fascinates me. But I'm also, I really love reading about, like, the police investigations. Like, when I read true crime myself, I really like it when people deep dive into, you know, the hunt, I guess, for, you know, a killer.
Yeah. So how do you do that? How do you go about investigating a story yourself?
Mm-hmm. So I was lucky enough for many years to work as a journalist at Leader Community Newspapers, which is part of News Corp. And so I'd have, I guess, access to different, you know, cases. So if there was something I wanted to follow up, I'd do it. And I'd occasionally go to court for things. But I really like going through, like, Trove. It's the online, the National Library of Australia, the online newspaper archive. And I just get obsessed with, like, searching for things. And also going to the State Library and looking through old microfiche of newspapers. It's like a hobby. It sounds strange, but I'll just go through it and find things that I'm interested in. And I found an article from, I think it was from the 1990s, and it was a Herald Sun article, and it was called Who Murdered Them? I think Michelle Coffey might have written it. And it just went through all the cold cases at that time in Melbourne and Victoria, and there were a few references, and one in particular, there was one about a lady called Nana Ellis, and she got murdered in Boronia in 1984. And I'm like, I've never heard of that. And I just get intrigued by things and I get a bit obsessed, and then I try and, you know, get more information, court documents, and things, I think if they're meant to be, things kind of happen. Like, you get in touch with a family member, or you're able to get in touch with a police officer, and it kind of rolls from there. So it's like my, I don't know, it's sort of my, not my passion, I guess, but I just really find it interesting.
I think you can say, maybe you feel weird about saying that other people's tragedy is your passion, but I can understand that. For this podcast, I often think of stories like that and think, well, I'd love to speak to the parents or the siblings or something, but I feel guilty. Mm. How do you approach someone and say, hi, I want to write a story about your mum, whose murder is one of the oldest cold cases in Victoria? How do you do that?
Well, I think I'm always wary that you've got to be really sensitive. And I think working as a journalist, you do, I guess, have an awareness of there's a line that you can't cross. Well, for me, I just couldn't live with myself if I really upset someone on purpose. So I just went, you know what, I don't care, I'm writing about that. So the stories that I wrote about and I interviewed people, I would contact, like, the police, I'd do my research, and just funny little things. I think technology's really helps you get in contact with people now. I actually put in a request to the police about this particular case, Nanette's case, and then I just ended up, I guess, you know, you track down people and you make connections, like by Facebook or LinkedIn or something like that, and I just go like, hi, this is, you know, I'm Emily, and I'm really wanting to write about, you know, this case. And sometimes they come back and say no. Other times, like, we meet, I'm like, it's all off the record, you know. I'm very respectful of that. I don't want to ever put someone in a position where they feel like they've been, you know, betrayed. Like, I really feel there's a real responsibility with true crime. People are going to get upset sometimes, I think, reading things. And also there's the fact that a lot of these cases, they're on the public record, so there's court documents and there's newspaper articles, so really, you know, you can write about them without necessarily getting in contact with the people, but I just feel it adds to something. But I couldn't contact all the people for the stories in the book, because it just was impossible, and some of them are quite historic, the cases, but I certainly, where possible, really tried to, you know, get a fresh angle on things.
What did you find out about Nanette? Because I felt like that story in particular, this is a collection of stories, these books are, but that story in particular felt like it felt really personal to you, even though you didn't know this lady, right?
No, I didn't know her, but it was really funny. There were some real connections that I didn't actually realise when I started to investigate. Like, Nanette actually worked at Leader Newspapers back in the 1980s. She was the newspaper manager for the newspaper called Free Press Leader that covers the Dandenongs and Belgrave. And I actually worked with people who worked with her back in the 80s. And I actually didn't know that she'd worked at Leader. So when I became a bit intrigued, I live in the outer east of Melbourne, so anything that happens around there, I'm quite fascinated. But what really intrigued me about this case is the police, I ended up getting in contact with the Victoria Police, and by chance they actually had started reinvestigating it. So I had a bit to do with a really great homicide detective called Kyle Simpson, and he was tasked with reinvestigating Nanette's murder. And Nanette just didn't have anything in her victimology, as they call it, that would suggest that she would be a target for a crime, you
know. That's what they say. I remember talking to Charlie Bazina, the former homicide detective, and he said, get to know your victim first, and more often than not, that will tell you who your perpetrator was. But yeah, with Nanette,
no,
there
nothing.
Didn't seem to be anyone or anything.
No, she was like a really lovely, beautiful mum, you know, in her, I think she was in her early 40s or might have been 40, and she, the day she was murdered, she'd come home from work and she was going to go out with some girls from work, and there was a window of time, about 45 minutes, where someone came into the house and stabbed her to death and then were gone, and her son actually discovered her, which I just can't even get my head around.
But the lead up was really strange too, wasn't it? A lot of strange things going on in her life.
Yes. So there was some incidents where she was driving to work. So from Nanette lived in Boronia and driving to Belgrave. And there were a few incidents where there were rocks thrown at her car on a series of days, and also her car was vandalised on the driveway. But police aren't actually sure now if that's necessarily was related to like, yeah. So I think there was a lot of emphasis at the time. And there actually wasn't really that much publicity at the time compared to what there would be today. I always remember Andrew Rule. There was a similar murder, not similar. There was another murder in 1984 that was of Infantry Gully, which is alongside Boronia, and it was of Margaret and Shauna Tapp, so a mum and daughter. Like, Shauna Tapp was 9 years old, and they were murdered in their beds, strangled. And Shauna was sexually assaulted. And I remember hearing reading something that Andrew Rule wrote, because he reported on that at the time, saying, you know, it got really scant publicity at the time for the kind of crime it was.
Yeah.
I just always wonder, like, why... Like,
yeah, do you have a theory about that? I mean, just recently we saw the Jill Maher murder, which rightfully gained an enormous amount of publicity. And then not long after, Tracy Connolly, the sex worker in St Kilda, was murdered. And that's still an open case. And not so much media.
Yeah, I think it's getting better. But I think, sadly, from my research, you discover that a lot of family violence murders have been happening for forever.
Yeah.
The way they're reported is very different, the language that's used. But I think, you know, like Jill, you know, walking home from work, she's young and beautiful.
Yeah.
I guess it's like Jane Thurgood Dove, you know, a young mum.
Yes.
It just captures your attention. I think it's like relatable.
Mm.
And it does instill fear in you. So I guess when stories are reported, you know, that plays a part, really.
Well, the Jane Thurgood Dove story was very, very widely reported. And, I mean, talk about relatable. Talk about a scenario we could all see ourselves in that was terrifying. Mm. A woman comes home, drives in her driveway with her kids in the car, steps out of her car, and there's a gunman waiting there, chasing her around the car.
It's just unbelievable.
And murders her.
And her parents, I met her parents. I was put onto them through an absolutely wonderful woman called Janine Greening, whose own mother was murdered in 2000 by two boys, teenagers.
Wow.
In Seaford. And Janine is an absolute warrior for victims' rights. And she has a group called the Victims of Homicide Group. And she is amazing. And she really helped me get in touch with a few people, and actually went and met with Jane's parents. And they're just the loveliest people. And it's like you sat in their house, the house where Jane grew up. They're such dignified, beautiful people, and it's like truly their life became a nightmare. One minute it was just, you know, the kind of life we live in suburbia, yeah, and then it became a complete nightmare, and I just couldn't get my head around it.
I read in your book where you said that they were showing you some home video, and her mum said it was from like the night before the murder, and her mum said that was the last time we were happy.
Yeah, and that just broke my heart. Oh. I couldn't, because I was like, I could be sitting with my grandparents, or like the house was really a real home, but you know, it was a very modest home, and they're modest people and hardworking people. And yeah, I don't know, I just can't.
And that story in particular, it turns out, was most likely, was believed to be a mistaken identity.
Yeah, they believe so, yeah, because someone up the road.
Gangsters were sent to shoot a blonde lady on that street and got the wrong house, and a blonde lady came home, so they thought it must have been her.
Yeah, yeah.
But the guy they think did it has died in prison, right?
Yeah, I think
Or died of overdose somewhere.
There's two suspects, well, people that they believe did it, who have died, and I think there's possibly either the person who stole the car or drove the ghetto, maybe stole the car, that they could still be out there, and also the person who organised the actual the hit. So I just really hope for them that they get an answer, because they're in their 80s now, Jane's parents, and I just think that would be really awful not to know.
Yeah. What about the triple killing? That one is just so terrifying. The housemates.
Yeah.
Can you talk us through those details, please?
So I wrote about that case, and I didn't speak to anyone for that personally, but there's a wealth of information out there, like court documents, media. I remember that I was at school when that happened. So it was the three young people, two girls who were trainee teachers, and one of the girls' brother-in-laws was staying at the house in Burwood. I mean, Burwood. It's pretty like nondescript. It's, you know.
Absolutely.
It's
for those outside of Melbourne, Burwood is one of those quiet, leafy, gentle suburbs that nothing ever happens in, better or for worse.
Yeah,
isn't
and
it?
It's pretty, you know, very solid eastern suburb kind of Melbourne place. And They were murdered. They were shot dead. And
it's got everything. If you put this story in a movie, people would say you were overreaching. One of the young women wasn't supposed to be there that night. She was moving out the next day.
Yes.
And she was supposed to be staying with her mum, but she said, oh, I don't want to leave my friend alone to interview new flatmates.
Mm-hmm.
So she just, you know, wasn't even meant to be there. She was there. Someone answered an ad, a complete random.
Mm, they had an ad in the paper for a housemate.
Mm.
And what they believe is that the person who murdered, executed these three people, Ashley Coulston, who's jailed for life, never to be released. They think it was completely random. He just answered an ad in the paper, opportunistic, and came to the door and, yeah, and then these three were, like, tied up and shot dead. It's just that the randomness of that, I guess, is so shocking because in a lot of cases the victim and perpetrator do know each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And we sort of rely upon that.
Well,
Well, you know, it's probably not going to happen to me. And people normally know their killers. For something like that to happen is just every person's worst nightmare.
And how he was caught was he'd actually tried to do another, like there was a couple walking through the gardens near St Kilda. And he tried to rob them and was about to tie them up, and they were very likely going to become murder victims had it not been some security guards heard what happened. And it was a very complex case. There were a lot of appeals, but he's one of Victoria's prisoners who will never be released, and just very, very dangerous. I mean, to do that randomly. I think he drove from Hastings, where he lived, to Burwood.
Yeah, so over an hour's drive.
Yeah, and I think there was I think he had in his mailways something plotted out that the police found. But yeah, it just tragic. And one of the girl's brothers-in-laws was staying there because he had a conference in Melbourne.
Right, he didn't even live there. He was never meant to be there.
I just don't get it. Like, just how people can do that.
No. Speaking of the never to be released, now when was that? There is a book by that name.
It's by Paul B. Kidd.
Yeah. So when was that law enacted? It wasn't that long ago, was it?
I think in New South Wales there was something called truth in sentencing. I'm not an expert.
Okay.
But it was where killers could have their sentences re-looked at, so some of the most brutal cases. But I think that affected some, I think, cases like the Anita Cobby murder, Janine Balding. But in Victoria, I'm not sure, but there's a handful of people who will never get out.
What sort of people are they?
I think, well, in New South Wales, I know there's Catherine Knight, who, murdered her partner and beheaded him and cooked his head in the pot.
Yes.
Crazy. I think they're going to make a film out of that. So she is the only woman to ever get that sentence. Roger Dean, who set the nursing home fire. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, I do.
I did write about my second book was called Angels of Death, and that was about healthcare serial killers, so doctors and nurses who killed. Very scary too. But Roger Dean, he set the fire to get the heat off, so to speak. He'd been stealing drugs and it obviously got out of control, but I think 11 or 12 people died and he is never to be released.
Yeah.
So he'll never get out. Ivan Milat in Melbourne, it's Ashley Coulston, and I think a more recent case is someone called Ramazan Akar, and he's known as the Facebook killer because he said he was about to kill his kid on Facebook.
Oh, yes.
He killed his little daughter, which is just the sickest thing ever, but it was like getting back at his ex-girlfriend, which, you know, they say that stuff is, those kind of crimes is the ultimate form of family violence. It's where the male, you know, kills the children, and it's, you know, so the woman suffers forever. So it's actually a recognised form of family violence. There's more understanding happening about it now. But, yeah, there's a few.
After the break, more polite conversation between two people who are trying to impress each other. Coming up on the Nitty Gritty Committee, Michelle tries to impress Emily by being overly complimentary about her writing and comes across a bit creepy. But first, more awkward conversation.
About Angels of Death.
Okay, so I wrote...
Fascinating.
When I first started out writing the books, I had just a couple of ideas, and I'd Angels of Death. So I wrote about healthcare serial killers, and I'd had a few ideas. There's obviously Harold Shipman in the United Kingdom, who was a GP in Manchester area, and he just killed so many people. And that actually, I thought I knew a lot about that case. I lived in the UK for quite a while, but I actually ended up reading through all the Shipman inquiry reports, and there was like seven of them, and it was just absolutely chilling. He would just literally like shoot them up with morphine and kill them. So a lot of these people were found, his patients who trusted him, mostly elderly, not always elderly. He'd kill them in the GP surgery or at home. And I saw a documentary, and one of the people from the funeral home commented that they often found these people dead in their chairs or fully dressed. And she said, just was a bit strange because usually they're in bed, they're in their pajamas, and alarm bells started to go off. But that was completely terrifying. But there's many instances in the United States. There was a nurse, a Texas nurse called Janine Jones, and she was a pediatric nurse, and she was convicted of killing one child but is believed to have killed many, many more as a neonatal nurse. And there's Beverly Aylett from the UK, the nurse who she overdosed some of her patients, her child patients, with insulin or suffocated them, and she, you know, has been widely reported as having the condition Munchausen's proxy.
Mm-hmm. Is that a common? I was just about to ask. Is there a sort of an idea that there's a common psychological through line with people who go into the caring professions and end up murdering people?
Yeah, some of the ones that have been that I reported on, they either have the Munchausen's by proxy, or they are people who, it sounds very odd, but they have particular stresses in their life, and that's how they kind of relieve their stress. Like one killer, I've forgotten his name. He's American, but he was a nurse, and he killed like hundreds of people, they believe. And he had a very sort of chaotic personal life, and he actually, yeah, it was like almost a stress relief for him. And also people who just have, like, they believe Harold Shipman, he just had this God complex, and he was, you know, they think he watched his mother die a very painful death from cancer, and she was given morphine, and he actually became a drug addict for a while, and got caught. He didn't get struck off, and then he was allowed to practice again, but I believe there's some psychological link with that. But in Roger Dean's case, I mean, he actually, you know, killed so many people because he set a fire to avoid being, you know, caught for taking drugs.
Yeah.
You know? So, but yeah, there's a bit of a theme where it's just they seem to believe that they can just do what they want.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're very vulnerable, obviously, in hospital. It's like easy victims.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Scary.
And an old age home. Munchausen's by proxy, is that the thing where, isn't that where we pretend our children are sick so we get attention?
That's often how it's reported. It was actually, interestingly, the condition was kind of discovered by Jane Asher, who was like once with Paul McCartney. She's like an English thing. Her dad was like this eminent doctor, and he kind of discovered it. But it's where, so if you've got Munchausen's, you like hurt yourself.
Okay.
But Munchausen's by proxy is like, yeah, where you hear those cases of parents making out their kids are sick, and the medical attention, it gives them a purpose and it gives them attention. It's like totally sick. Why would you want to pretend that your child's sick? Or hurting other people.
Yeah, wow, to get attention. Mm. I guess if everyone thinks you're the poor, unlucky nurse who keeps having a death on your shift, you probably get attention out of that.
That's it. And one of them, actually, Janine Jones, they used to say, like, they called her shift the death shift, because she was on, kids just died, and they had to start investigating. So often the common theme is when they start going back through records, they're like, oh, when that person's on shift, interestingly, people die. So what actually was really scary too about writing that book is the mismanagement of staff, like when little alarm bells start to go off, and the bureaucratic process, and people die in that, you know, while they're investigating stuff. And I mean, I think things would be a lot stricter now, but some of the cases, people were just allowed to do what they want. And also people who possibly shouldn't have been nursing, like they had incidences where they may have stolen drugs or, you know, done something wrong. They could have been easily sort of managed out of the job, but they just were allowed to keep practicing.
Wow. What about, what was that story that you sent me the link for on YouTube?
So one of the cases I wrote about originally for a story for when I was working on Leader newspapers, it's the case of Susie Lawrence. Mm-hmm. Now, Susie was 17 and she went missing from Healesville, which is in the Yarra Valley, mm-hmm. In 1987. And
beautiful, like rural setting.
Yeah, gorgeous. It's a lot. It's back then it was like really country.
Yeah.
Now it's like be hip, slick and cool, and it's very a beautiful foodie destination. But back then it was really like a country town, very close to Melbourne. And I ended up contacting her mum, Liz Westwood, who's just a lovely lady. And I rang her up and I was really nervous. And I said, "Hi, Liz. Like, you know, I'm a journalist with Leader Newspapers. I'm doing stories about unsolved crimes in the Outer East. I wondered if I could meet you to speak about Susie." And she like rang, when she rang me back, she just broke down in tears. And because so long had gone, and she feels a lot of guilt. She always feels like she never looked hard enough for Susie. And it's so sad that she feels that way, because, you know, what happened was when Susie went missing, she was at a party, went to a party. Liz dropped her off. She was, you know, 21st party at the Memorial Hall in Healesville. She was in a, you know, 1980s taffeta party frock. And Liz said the next morning, you know, she wasn't back, but she said that wasn't unusual because the kids all stayed at other people's places, and Liz had actually then gone to a country music festival in Yarra Glen. And she didn't see Susie there, but someone had sighted Susie apparently. And so, but then Susie didn't come home. And back then, you know, there weren't all the networks, the missing people's networks. You'd go to the cops and they're like, "Oh, she'll turn up. It'll be okay." And she didn't turn up. And, you know, Liz was a widow at that time. She had three other kids working, and, you know, she did all she could. But she, yeah, just nothing happened. And maybe she joined a group for people of missing children. So she knows people like Jenny Bird, who's the mother of Prue Bird, mm-hmm. who went missing, and they believe that, well, I think he has been charged, Leslie Camilleri, who killed the two girls in Bega, he did that, but Prue's never been found. So she knows, you know, Prue Bird. She knew the parents of the two backpackers, two of Ivan Malat's victims, Deborah Everest and James Gibson, who went missing. And at the time, they didn't know that they were victims of Ivan Milat. No. So there was quite an active group for a while in the late 80s, early 90s.
Of these parents
who
sought support from each other.
That's it.
As the parents of missing
and did,
teenagers.
You know, did sort of awareness, you know, campaigns on media. Liz actually did participate in a reenactment of Susie's disappearance for, I think it was Australia's Most Wanted, which was back on TV. But so really the story is Susie was sighted. She left the party. She left the party a bit upset about something. She'd actually had a car accident the year before and had been quite badly injured, and she was walking with a limp. And you know, Liz said probably there were some girls who might have been having a bit of a laugh at her because she was, you know, dancing with them. But she left, and someone had said, "Do you want us to walk you home or something?" She's like, "No, I'm fine." There was a witness who said they saw her the next day in completely different clothes with a couple of boys that weren't local. But there's also the mystery I find is what happened to the dress. It was like a full-on party dress. And she, there's just a lot of things that, I don't know, I think how can you explain that? Why was it investigated differently? But I have had some contact, like, for instance, the lady who proofread my book, the latest book, she actually knows someone who went to school with Susie and was like, "Wow, you know, everyone always wonders what happened." But there were a few leads, as I describe in the book, you know, where police said, "Oh, we think we might have had a sighting," and Liz travelled off to places, but it wasn't to be. And now Liz is in her 70s and really wants to know what happened. She's always held a hope that Susie just disappeared.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But she said what she couldn't work out is she was very close to one of her brothers, and just to go missing, you know, and never tell the brother, and they've all been affected by it. Liz has since remarried. She's married to a really lovely man, and but everyone's been impacted by it. But she wants to know, and I think she's, without speaking on her behalf, I think she's kind of, she just wants to know what happened. Whereas before, it's like going to the darkest place was really hard for her to think,
yeah.
you know, what happened. So it's probably likely that Susie met with some sort of foul play, but I just...
And even then, yeah. though, you're so right. What happened to the dress? Like, yeah. what happened?
Someone knows, you yeah. know. Someone knows what happened, and it's just cruel, you know. It's cruel to not... Yeah, but I've become friends with Liz. Actually, I'm going to catch up with her. I told her about I was doing this, and I said, look, Jim, can I talk about Susie? She said, that's fine. And she's, yeah, she's become a friend. She's such a lovely lady.
Does she want... Is she happy when the case comes up again in terms of you publicising it and reminding people, and is she still in that space?
She was happy because for a really, really long time she wasn't she sort of hadn't gone to the police to say what had yeah. kind of happened. She felt like it had all been, well, from what she knew, the case had kind of been exhausted and it was just a mystery. But she had actually been thinking, she said, about going, and I think maybe me contacting her gave her a bit of confidence with that. And I believe she has made some contact with the missing person and cold case squad at Victoria Police. But, you know, it's going to be slow going because I guess there's a lot of other cases, but Susie's case definitely deserves a relook. But, I mean, I guess if there's no new leads, it's going yeah. to be tricky. But sometimes I just hope, it's like the case in Shepparton where the young journalist Tammy Mills, you know, she said to Ron Idles, hey, why don't you investigate this murder of Michelle Buckingham? You know, it was, and actually someone who knew something 30 years later felt mm-hmm. compelled to come forward. So I really think someone knows what happened to Susie. Yeah, and it would be great if someone came forward.
Ron Idles, of course, the homicide cop from Victoria, who's the subject of the recent book, The Job.
Yeah.
So he's got a lot of media lately. He is one of those stalwart homicide cops in Victoria, isn't he, in
yeah,
Melbourne?
Yeah, he is, and people know, you know, I think because Ron always comes across, he really cares about, you know, the people he deals with.
Yeah.
And it's a really big responsibility. And, yeah, I think it'd be a huge burden, that job, but it would also be you would feel just amazing when you get results for families.
Yeah. Well, he's retired now, hasn't
yeah.
he, from
yeah.
active service, but I think he works with the sort of police association.
Yeah, he was the head of it, and now I think he retired from that. Oh, did he? No, he is the head of the police association. You're
yeah.
right. Yeah, yeah.
And I noticed recently, though, when I was looking around and researching the Sarah McDermott story,
yeah.
Which we'll get to in a second, but his mobile number is still on the website.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
That's pretty intense, isn't it? I think the older detectives find it really difficult to retire
yep.
and move past their careers when they have these unsolved things yep. in their case file.
Mm, definitely.
Sarah McDermott, an incredible story of a young girl who got a train home. Again, it's kind of a story that our parents point to and say, never do this, which is not victim blaming. I think it's just so frightening when you see a young woman get off her train and walk to her car. Her DNA on the car.
I think there was there blood,
I think it's
blood stains.
Yeah.
And she just disappeared. She'd been playing tennis, I think, in the city, came home to Cannanook to a car. Someone heard a scream. That was about all that was heard.
Yeah, Cannanook's sort of in the bush, just yeah, outside of Melbourne.
Yeah, like Frankston line.
Yeah. And so she's come home and I guess her car was the only one left in the car park.
Yeah, and look, back then probably the lighting wasn't as,
yeah.
you know, great. The stations weren't as...
Mm.
you know, user-friendly as they are now. And, yeah, that's a real Melbourne mystery tragedy, really.
Mm.
And I think, yeah, a lot of people would like to see that solved, but it's just frightening. She's just, yeah, no trace of her.
No. You have a lot of people contact you, though, don't you?
I do. It's funny. I have I get people contacting me like, have you considered writing about this case or this case? And quite a few about the case of Kylie Mabry, and I won't say too much because that's before the courts have actually arrested someone,
okay, right.
Charged someone. That was the 1984 murder of Kylie Mabry, who was 8 and went to get some sugar in Preston from the shop and disappeared and was found raped and had been murdered. And I had a lot of, like, people who went to school with Kylie contacting me. And I actually had a really interesting contact. I did a chapter in the first book. I found several cases of some really horrific child murders in the 1970s in Sydney.
And one of them was of these two boys, I think they were aged 8 and 12, and they were murdered in separate incidents in the Glebe area. And the person who did it was actually a teenager himself.
Wow.
I think he was 17 when he was arrested and charged. But back then, I didn't name him in my book, but back then the newspapers named you if you were under 18.
Wow.
Photo on the front page. And I thought, just, I was trying to apply my media training of today. Yeah. But I actually got contacted by a retired priest. He read the book and he actually sent me this bundle of stuff because he was actually the, for want of a better word, spiritual advisor for this boy who murdered these kids. So he sent me like the sentencing remarks. He sent me the newspapers from the time and he sent me this background about this murderer. Who and what his life was like, and it had details. It's stuff you think, oh, I wish I had this when I was writing it. But you know, this the perpetrator had actually had a really tragic background themselves, and you don't. I guess you feel a bit sorry for them, but you think, gosh, like what he did was so bad. But he actually ended up getting released, so he's probably living somewhere. I don't know, could be alive, could be dead, living somewhere, maybe got on with his life. But yeah, this priest was really, I thought, wow, that's so amazing that you sent. He said, I guess he figures he's got no use for it, and he said, you know, here you go, he sent me the stuff. So I do get contacted, some interesting emails from people, but often it's people saying, do you remember this case, do you think you could write about this case?
I can't imagine what it must be like to be a kid in primary school and have that happen to a kid that you go to school with.
I know, and they're very – I actually had some dealings too with a schoolmate of little Shauna Tapp, who was the little girl murdered in Ferntree Gully, and just traumatised.
Yeah.
Like for certain kids, it just completely rocks their world and they're affected even into adulthood by it.
Mm. Are you looking on any cases at the moment, working on anything?
Sort of just like having a little double round. I mean, there's certain cases. I'm always intrigued by the Mr. Krull case because for me that was my generation's bogeyman. Like I grew up in Ringwood.
Uh-huh.
One of the victims was from Ringwood.
Talk us through that because I was a child in Queensland at the time.
Okay.
And I've never been able to get my head around it. I can't believe that happened. I've seen the vision of the little girl wrapped in the blanket that they found the next suburb over, whom he had let go.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that case.
So basically how it started was it was in the late 80s and very early 1990s, and there was a little girl that was abducted from her house, Sharon, and she was 10 years old. She was abducted from her bedroom at night and found, I don't know if it was 24 hours later or so, but she was wrapped in a garbage bag in Bayswater. And then it happened again. There was another girl abducted, and she was abducted from the Canterbury area. Same sort of thing. The person came in, abducted them. She was released. And then there was Carmen Chan, who was murdered. She was abducted from her Templestowe home, and they found her remains, I think, in Thomastown, and she'd been shot in the head, and they believe they were all victims of the same man who was dubbed Mr. Krull by the media. And it's just like this huge mystery.
They believe, like, that Carmen saw his face.
Yeah, that's why
the other
believe.
Girls didn't.
Yeah, and
that's why he shot her.
And there's peculiarities to, you know, how he spoke to them. He used very specific language, like I think he said, just funny, quaint terms he used with them, and they think he could have been working in the education system because they happened in the school holidays, and he maybe had some knowledge of scientific forensic procedures because there was no DNA, you know, no DNA
left.
That's
why he bathed the girls. He's very careful to clean them.
And where the girls were held, they believe it could have been near the airport because the way the girls described the house, there was sounds of airplanes. But for my generation, like I'm nearly 40, and that was our, like, that was, you know, Mr. Krull, scary as, you know, at the time.
To be taken from your own bed.
Yeah, and it's really amazing that these girls survived, you know.
Yeah.
Two of them,
and he was never found.
Never found. So I think I was listening to when you spoke to Charlie Bazina, and the general thought is he's either in jail for something else or he's dead or he's overseas.
Mm.
Yeah,
that people don't just stop.
Yeah, I'm always intrigued by that. I just think that's one that so many people would like to be solved.
Oh, absolutely. I'm also intrigued by something you said a minute ago about it's this guy who was 17 years old and murdered two younger boys who is now out of prison, whether he's still alive or not. I mean, in your research, do you find a lot of those? Do you find a lot of cases where you think, oh, my God, that person is out and about?
Yeah, you think – I sort of do a little bit of bit of my own research, and you sometimes wonder, oh, I wonder if the thing with Facebook and that, though, you can sort of, you know, find people. And I mean, I would never go so far as to like flat out ask someone if they were so and so, but I always find it intriguing. How do you go on after that? Like, there's the case of of the little boy Daniel Valerio. I don't think you probably would have lived in Melbourne at the time, but he had been was bashed, abused. And it's like something you remember so much. The front page of was his little face, and it was all bruised.
This was a doc's case,
and it changed. So the statutory reporting laws came in after that. The doctors, nurses, childcare workers, etc., had to report suspicions of abuse. So the person who killed him, his stepfather, is now out, you know, and wanting to, I think he was in the news because he wanted to have IVF with his partner so he could have more kids. I'm like, how does that even, I don't know, I just don't get it.
No.
How do you move on?
It takes you back to the Jill Maher case. Obviously not everybody, it's inappropriate and silly to think that you should go away for the rest of your life, I guess.
But you've got to have rehabilitation. Like, I am a believer. I got kind of really slayed on social media for making a comment about one of the one of the Manson, you know, family people, one of the women is, her sentence was she got a possibility of parole, and she's been in jail for like 45 years, totally rehabilitated, you know, a real model prisoner. And I said, well, you know, let her out. Oh, my gosh. I'm terrified by people who I was like scared. I got all these comments, you're crazy, you're like killer, you know, you're insane. I was like, mainly from American people. I just put a link on one of my Facebook pages, and it was really, people have really strong views about it. It really polarizes people.
And yet, I got the same kind of attitude when I talked about Stephen Avery case. To me, he is clearly a violent, scary man who probably murdered this woman. I don't have any trouble believing that he murdered Teresa Halbach at all. Wow, the feedback I got on that was pretty heavy as well.
I still haven't, for someone who's into true crime, I actually haven't seen Making a Murderer.
Oh, my God. But, all right.
But I read, probably 2 years ago, I actually got sent the book by the prosecutor in the case he'd written. He'd been re-released, and I reviewed it, not even making an association recently, but I haven't even seen it. But I know I've got people I know on, you know, my social media who are like so into it. Yeah. And I don't know. I just feel like it's just true crime. It just gets you so fired up about things.
God.
And
it's got Emily Webb written all over it. Let me tell you, Making a Murderer, you are going to love it so much.
Oh, I need time. I keep being scared to fall into the Netflix rabbit hole. I'm like, oh, my house will become a pigsty.
But please do me a favour and call me when you've watched it, because I really want to hear your thoughts as soon as you finish watching it. It's fascinating. And true crime is fascinating. I always feel a bit guilty about the fact that I'm really into it. But then I read your books and think, well, she's more into it, so.
I just feel like so intrigued by it, and I've got my personal favourite authors that I love.
Yeah, tell us what's great. What should we be reading if we're into true crime?
Okay, so I think I'm a really big believer in you've got to go the classic true crime. Like, there's a lot of true crime out there, but you need to read things like Gordon Byrne, who is deceased now, but he wrote an amazing book about Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, called Somebody's Husband, Somebody's Son. Mm-hmm. His writing style is incredible, so that's a must read.
What about the old The Killer Beside Me? Is that what
The Stranger Beside Me?
The Stranger Beside Me.
And Rule. That's
amazing.
A must read.
Amazing. Yep. I mean, here she is, a budding crime writer like you, a budding true crime writer, and the guy that she works with in a telecommunications place in a call centre is Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
And it's such a great book.
Isn't it?
It's fantastic. Yes. And she, so I do love Anne Rule. Mm. She's like, she's the queen of true crime. And yeah. she, I think she died last year.
Yeah.
But Gordon Byrne is definitely, you've got to get into it. There's also one that's written, it was written in the 60s in a time where the true crime genre, it was sort of frowned upon. It's called Beyond Belief by Emlyn Williams, mm. who was a playwright. And he wrote it about the Moors murderers, like Myra Hindley.
Yes,
that's
right.
A classic. It might take a while to get used to the style, but he's actually written it. It's like imagining them.
Wow.
You know, it's not like hardcore, just facts. But that's, I think that's definitely a must read.
I read another book about Myra 2 or 3 years ago, a newer one. I can't remember what it was called, but it was amazing.
You'll find it. Inside... I think it's something like Inside the Mind of a Murderess or something
like that.
Is that what I read that when I was about 15. I was like, oh my God, I can't put this down.
God, I mean, what a strange fish this woman is or was. Myra Hindley.
Yeah.
Just if you in any way have a passing interest in true crime, isn't she a fascinating specimen?
She is. She, I mean, she, you know, was in this relationship with Ian Brady, who's still alive
mm.
and still won't give up, you know, to where some of the bodies are buried.
Yeah.
But I guess the thing was...
And the two of them killed small children.
Yeah, and she actually, she couldn't claim to be, have been in a, you know, sometimes women are under the spell, I guess, so to speak, of these men, because she actually lured, you know, she lured these kids into the car and...
With the little dog.
Yeah, and just
And then they'd take photos of her and the little dog next to the graves.
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
Tourist photos.
Just so, so strange. And she, I mean, I know... She became like there were people who were campaigners for her to possibly get released down the track.
Yeah.
Look, I guess I don't know. I've obviously never been in prison, so I don't know what happens there. But I guess with the passage of time, things change. You know, you might get opportunities to reflect, probably. But she, I think she was in Holloway Women's Prison for like most of her sentence. I think she.
I'll ask you the same question I asked Charlie, which was, what makes a murderer, do you think? What turns people like you and I into people who've killed someone?
I think...
I mean, apart from the obvious, like, just not obvious, apart from the really strange, I'm going to drive for an hour and a half to kill randoms that I found on an ad, but apart from that, that's just a whole other thing, but...
I think people who have had... abuse themselves and been traumatized, but that's to say other people, you know, that doesn't necessarily make you a murderer.
No.
There's people who've had horrific things happen and they don't, but you know, there's that saying hurt people. I don't know if that's drugs. I think people are just so off their chops on like drugs, especially these days on ice. I mean, I do actually believe there is evil. Like, I believe in God, so I believe there's got to be...
Okay.
You know, there's got to be that opposing thing. And
wow.
I don't know, maybe just an absence, like, this like the psychopath stuff like Ted Bundy, that absence of something in your brain that, you know, allows you to feel that what you're doing is, you know, going to hurt someone.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Do you believe that people can be born evil?
I don't know. This is a really tough question.
And whenever I think of that question myself, I immediately picture the CCTV of James Bulger being led from a shopping centre by two other little boys who murdered him. And I think you sort of got to feel like at least one of those kids was born evil, haven't
you? Like they say born bad or something.
Yeah.
I think definitely like an environment... An environment of like abuse and deprivation and stuff would make someone like that. But then you read things about newborn babies, they can get like their brains get rewired if they're deprived of love and attention. I think there's so many kids who that happens to, and it's just but I wonder, because I guess if you believe in heaven, there's got to be a hell. I don't know. It's a big question.
Yeah, no one's ever said that to me before, though. I like that. If you believe in one, you kind of got to believe in the other. Thank you so much, Emily. We must chat again. I just could talk to you all day long. So we've got Murder in Suburbia as the first book. Then Angels of Death, which is about healthcare professionals who kill, and Suburban Nightmare, which is the current book. True crime stories from Australia. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime, which was actually an old episode of my other podcast, The Nitty Gritty Committee. It's Christmas. It's a crazy, crazy time of year, and I'm quite drunk. I'm actually not. It's just Christmas.
'Cause Christmas time is killing us. Killing us. Christmas time is killing us.
Yeah.